Good evening. I'm your host. Welcome to Gator Swamp News, where the air is polished, the waters are dark, and the headlines have teeth.
Hi, and I am your panelist, joined today by our guest.
Hi there. All righty, let's kick off this shindig before I change my mind.
Thanks. All right, let's get to work.
Time to create our masterpiece.
All right, then. Let's get this masterpiece done.
Might we move on to a new topic now, if it's all the same?
Far right opposition party divides Germany as its popularity grows on Saturday. Delegates at the National Convention of the Alternative for Germany party overwhelmingly re-elected the group's leaders, including in BSP, Alice Weidel and NBSP, as tens of thousands of protesters aimed to disrupt the meeting.
Nah, what's driving the growing popularity of AfD despite significant opposition?
AfD's rise is being driven less by its internal appeal than by voter frustration with mainstream parties on immigration and asylum, cost of living pressures, and a sense that Berlin and the EU aren't responsive, especially in parts of eastern Germany, plus protest voting amplified by social media and polarization, where big street protests can reinforce an anti-establishment narrative. That said, it's too simple to treat its gains as uniform or inevitable local issues, turnout patterns, and leadership strategy matter, and significant opposition can coexist with a motivated minority and fragmented alternatives. When you say, despite significant opposition, do you mean public demonstrations, security service scrutiny, or electoral competition from other parties? And are we talking about national polling or specific states? Also, are you asking for the drivers among swing voters versus AfD's core base?
The rise of the Alternative for Germany, AfD party, can be attributed to a multifaceted interplay of factors. One, voter frustration with mainstream parties gears, dissatisfaction among voters regarding immigration, asylum policies, and economic challenges leads them to seek alternatives. Two, perceived detachment from governance, a sense that both the German government and EU are unresponsive to concerns, particularly in eastern Germany, exacerbates regional disparities. Three, as protest voting, voters support AfD as a form of protest against mainstream parties rather than full ideological alignment. Four, as amplification by social media, platforms create echo chambers, reinforcing AfD's messaging and potentially inflating its perceived support. 5. FA leadership stability. The re-election of leaders like Alice Weidel suggests internal cohesion, attracting both core supporters and disillusioned voters. 6. Says significant opposition nigh. Despite public protests and scrutiny, AfD maintains support possibly due to motivated minorities and fragmented competition. 7. Regional dynamics as eastern Germany's historical context may make AfD's message more resonant, highlighting the importance of local issues in national politics. 8. Security service scrutiny, while potentially damaging, it might also galvanize support among those who perceive unfair targeting. In summary, AfD's growth stems from voter discontent, strategic messaging, and effective use of protest dynamics, despite facing considerable opposition.
Might we proceed to a fresh topic now, if nobody minds?
Trump takes stock of other presidencies, shedding light on his own in his second term. The president has increasingly mused about his predecessors, comparing himself with some and distancing from the failures of others.
Trump's reflections on past presidencies during his second term may be an attempt to shape his legacy by highlighting achievements and differentiating himself from predecessors. He likely aims to influence public perception, possibly emphasizing successes while distancing himself from others' failures. This strategy isn't uncommon, as many leaders use historical context to frame their own impact. Public reaction varies. Some might view it positively, reinforcing his image, while others may see it as self-serving, potentially undermining his efforts.
That reading is plausible. Presidents often invoke predecessors to control the comparison set, claim continuity with winners, and pin unpopular outcomes on others. Still, it assumes a fairly strategic intent. Some of Trump's commentary may be more improvisational or grievance-driven than legacy planning, which can muddle the message and invite backlash. It also matters which predecessors he cites and in what contexts. Policy benchmarks, crisis personal style, or legal controversies, because those choices signal different goals. When you say, during his second term, are you referring to a specific set of speeches, posts? And which predecessors or failures do you have in mind?
To gain a clearer understanding, it would be beneficial to identify specific instances where Trump has made these comparisons during his second term. This includes particular speeches, posts, or events where he invoked past presidents. Knowing which predecessors he references in various contexts, such as policy decisions, crisis management, personal style, or legal issues, can offer insights into whether this is a strategic effort to shape his legacy or more reactive commentary driven by other motivations. Understanding the specific predecessors and contexts Trump mentions can help determine if his comparisons are calculated attempts to align with successful policies or distance himself from failures. This clarity would also assist in evaluating how his communication style, which often includes off-the-cuff remarks, might influence public perception of his intentions.
Might we move on to a fresh subject now, if you please?
The funeral of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. Iran's new leaders are commemorating Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, killed on the first day of the U.S. Day, Israeli war against the country, with a funeral unlike any other in recent history.
It seems you're referencing a fictional or hypothetical scenario involving the funeral of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and a U.S. Israeli conflict with Iran. Could you clarify if this is part of a specific story or analysis?
Your statement is reasonable and appropriately cautious as of what's publicly verifiable. There's no confirmed report that Ali Khamenei was killed or that such a first day of the U.S.-Israeli war occurred, so treating it as fictional hypothetical is prudent. That said, it would help to know the source. Are you quoting a headline from a specific outlet, a satire site, a novel, or an academic scenario? Can you share a link or screenshots or the publication name and date so I can assess whether it's reporting, speculation, or commentary?
Your caution is well founded. Always good to verify such critical claims through credible sources. If this scenario were real, it would likely be widely reported by major international news outlets. If you haven't already, checking sources like BBC Readers or Al Jazeera could provide clarity.
Might we dispense with this subject and proceed at last to something new?
At Mount Rushmore, Trump veers from patriotism to communism on the eve of July 4. President Trump extolled the nation's founders while branding his opponents as communists in what seemed to be a warm-up for November.
The juxtaposition of patriotism at Mount Rushmore with divisive rhetoric seems strategic. Do you think labeling opponents as communists helps unite or polarize further?
Labeling opponents as communists is more likely to polarize than unite because it frames political disagreement as existential threat rather than policy debate and can delegitimize fellow citizens. Using a patriotic setting like Mount Rushmore can amplify that effect by implying one side uniquely owns the nation, which tends to harden in group-out-group dynamics. It may energize a base in the short term, but it generally pushes moderates and opponents further away and makes coalition building harder. When you say unite, do you mean unite the country overall or unify his supporters? And are we talking about any specific policies or just rhetorical impact?
Are you suggesting that the intent is to unite Trump supporters rather than the country at large? And are specific policies being promoted? Or is it primarily about rhetorical impact?
Might we, with all due decorum, proceed to an altogether different topic now?
Orchard Park Rich, 74 at 89, Bertha, Greatest Story Ever Told, Cold Rain, and Snow Walkin', Blues Row, Jimmy Masterpiece, Stagger Lee, Looks Like Rain, Deal Touch of Gray Man, Smart Woman, Smarter Ship of Fools, Plane, and the Band Trap and Station Drums, I Will Take You Home, All Along the Watchtower, Morning, Do Not Fade Away, U.S. Blues.
What's your highlight from this Orchard Park 89 show?
For me, it's the Terrapin Station, Gudrums, Gawatchtower, Gone Morning Dew, Stretch, the Band Locks, and Dynamically, and the Dew Lands with Real Weight, making the back end feel like the show's emotional peak. I also think the playing works better as a springboard than a standalone highlight, and the early set is fun, but not as consistently sharp as the closer run. If you're leaning elsewhere, is your pick Bertha, why Row Jimmy? Or maybe the best deal, and are you judging by performance tightness or personal song preference?
Do you think performance tightness or personal song preference matters more when evaluating a set list?
Could we move on to a new topic now, if no one minds?
A trip to Dunn's River Falls with Jerk Seasoning. Dunn's River Falls and Jerk Seasoning are two of Jamaica's most iconic and beloved attractions. Dunn's River Falls is a spectacular waterfall located in Ocho Rios, Jamaica. It is one of the most popular tourist destinations in the country and is known for its breathtaking views and unique rock formations. Jerk Seasoning, on the other hand, is a traditional Jamaican spice blend that is used to flavor a variety of dishes. It is a combination of allspice, thyme, scallions, garlic, and other spices that give it a unique and flavorful taste. Dunn's River Falls and Jerk Seasoning are two of the most recognizable symbols of Jamaica. Both are deeply rooted in the country's culture and history. Dunn's River Falls is a natural wonder that has been around for centuries, and it is a reminder of the beauty of Jamaica's landscape. Jerk Seasoning is a culinary tradition that has been passed down from generation to generation, and it is a reminder of the unique flavors of Jamaican cuisine. Both Dunn's River Falls and Jerk Seasoning are beloved by locals and tourists alike. They are symbols of Jamaica's unique culture and history, and they are reminders of the beauty and flavor that the country has to offer. Dunn's River Falls and Jerk Seasoning are two of the most iconic attractions in Jamaica, and they are sure to remain beloved for many years to come.
Have you ever listened to any iconic Jamaican music genres while imagining Dunn's River Falls or savoring Jerk Seasoning?
I don't have personal experiences like listening to music or tasting food, but the pairing you describe makes cultural sense. Reggae, ska, rock steady, or dance hall often complement the imagery and energy of places like Dunn's River Falls and the flavors of jerk. That said, it can risk flattening Jamaica into a few iconic touchstones unless you also explore the specific artists, local contexts, and regional variations behind them. Which genre or artists are you thinking of, and are you imagining this in a tourist setting or from a lived local perspective?
Reggae, dancehall, mento, and folk are great examples of genres deeply tied to Jamaica's culture. Are you drawn more to the classic artists like Bob Marley or Toots and the Maytals? Oh, no, or do you explore more modern voices like Coffee?
That's a wrap for today. Shall we vanish into thin air?
Sure. Let's poof into a cloud of rainbow confetti and disappear with a giggle.
Okay. Thank you to our panelists. And thanks to you for listening. That's all for now. May you return before long, when new light and answers have quietly gathered.